From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Tariq Gross with Fresh Air. It's hardly uncommon to find Stephen King on the bestseller list, but now he has 5 titles on the New York Times paperback list. He's also overseeing production of a miniseries remake of The Shining. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature a 1992 interview with King, in which we talked about his writing and about the times in his life when he's been most terrified and in the most pain. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Metallica's new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Well, these are good times for Stephen King fans. He has 5 books on the New York Times paperback bestseller list, his novel Rose Matter, and 4 installments of his 6-part serial thriller, The Green Mile. In the fall, he'll have 2 new novels, and next winter, ABC will air a miniseries remake of The Shining. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1992 interview with King. Some of his best-known books have been made into films, including Misery, Carrie, The Shining, The Dead Zone, Cujo, Pet Sematary, and Dolores Claiborne. I spoke to King after the publication of his novel, Gerald's Game. As the book opens, a married couple is in their forest cabin. They're ready to play their S&M sex game. She's on the bed, her wrists are cuffed to the bedposts, he's undressing. She realizes she's tired of this game. It seems stupid, ridiculous, corny. But she can't get her husband to stop, and that makes her furious. As he forces himself on her, she kicks him where it hurts most, he collapses, suffers a heart attack, and dies. And she's alone, cuffed to the bed in the middle of the woods. Now the horror really begins. I asked Stephen King what made him think about how corny sex games can be.
Actually, Gerald's Game started with the concept of the woman being chained to the bed. I'd written a book before where a woman and a small child were stuck in a car that was sort of surrounded, if you will, by a rabid St. Bernard. That book was called Cujo. And essentially what a lot of that book was 2 people in a very small room, although it did have a shifting perspective so that it went to other characters. And I thought originally this was the takeoff point for the book. Wouldn't it be interesting to see what would happen if you had 1 character in a room? The question then became, what caused this woman to be in this room by herself? And the answer that I came up with was bondage. She's handcuffed to a bed. And that forced me to sort of consider what causes people to do this sort of thing. And so once I'd set up the situation, I knew what it was going to be. I went in and read a little bit about it and thought a little bit about it. And the whole thing struck me as a little bit Victorian. There was something very snidely whiplash about the whole thing, and I tried to get that into the book.
Well, you do in a very funny way. I mean, the husband says to his wife as she's handcuffed to the bedpost, he says, "I'll teach you me proud beauty."
Yes, exactly.
Pronouncing beauty the way the landlord in a bad Victorian melodrama might.
You can almost see him waxing his mustaches, can't you?
Right, right, right. So you got the corniness and the danger of this kind of S&M sex play. In an interview a few years ago, you once said that one of the major reasons that you've been left alone is that your books are fairly asexual. Is this a change for you?
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, Peter Straub, with whom I collaborated on a book once called The Talisman, once joked and said, "Stevie hasn't discovered sex yet." But actually, I never saw any particular reason to go into sex unless it formed an integral part of the plot. It never had before, and here it does. You know, it's a little bit like that story that you sometimes hear about the little kid. Everybody assumes that he's mute. He doesn't say anything until he's 4 years old, and then one day in perfectly articulated English, he says to his mother, "Mother, may I have a glass of water?" And she says, "You talk. Why didn't you ever say anything before?" And he says, "All my needs were met. I never had to. This is, you know, the first time that it came up." So for me, this was the first time that sex came up in the course of you know, as it being a main element in terms of driving the plot. And it gave me a chance to take a look at a wide range of not only sexual material, but I don't know what you call it, stuff that ranged from the pornographic to the merely titillating. And a lot of what I saw through the considering eye of somebody who was planning to write about this, who used this as a building block, was a little disturbing. It seemed to me that there was a lot of stuff about men wanting to be empowered, to be in control in a way that struck me, at least, as essentially unhealthy, which in turn kicked off a whole sort of subplot, a center of the book that has to do with child molestation and maybe where some of these things come from.
Mm-hmm. This is hardly, though, the first time you've tried writing about sex. You once tried to write a porn novel while you were still in college. But you
yeah, I did.
Do it.
I did actually try to write a porn novel when I was in college. But you have to realize that I was stony broke. I was living in a place called the University Cabins, living on fried Cheerios and peanut butter and beer. And I'd read in a writer's magazine that there were a couple of publishing companies, I think one of them was Olympia Books, that would pay $600 to $800 cash on acceptance for porno novels that ran from, I think, 25,000 to 40,000 words. I read a couple of things from the market and thought, I can do that in $600 isn't much, but I can do it in 10 days, and that's a living wage, and at least it will buy some hamburger to go with the fried Cheerios. And so I tried, but I just couldn't make it happen. I mean, I reached a point where I just tipped over, and what I was writing at that moment was a scene where two twin sisters are having lesbian sex in a birdbath, and I got to that point and I just said, hey, no, I'm sorry, I can't do this.
What was it about that scene that you couldn't take any further?
It wasn't the fantasy element. I'm not sure I can answer your question. I'm very comfortable with fantasy, as people who've read my books for years know, but I just couldn't believe it anymore myself. I think that one of the integral things about fantasy that makes it palatable to readers is that if the writer actually believes it himself, at least while he's writing it, and at this point I just collapsed into, I can remember very clearly sitting in front of the typewriter, which was on the old kitchen table, and just laughing until tears rolled out of my eyes and just throwing the whole thing in the wastebasket. It wasn't happening for me.
Let's get Stephen King to the kind of gore and terror and suspense that you create. There's a scene in Gerald's Game, your new novel, that I'd like you to read from. And this is a scene in which the wife is still handcuffed to the bedpost. Her husband is laying dead on the floor, and a stray vicious dog from the area has walked into the house and has started dining on the woman's dead husband. Would you read it for us?
I sure will. Gerald's widow's peak was in disarray, probably as a result of the dog's licking the blood out of it. But his glasses were still firmly in place. She could see his eyes, half open and glazed, glaring up from their puffy sockets at the fading sun ripples on the ceiling. His face was still a mask of ugly red and purple blotches, as if even death had not been able to assuage his anger at her sudden capricious. Had he seen it as capricious? Of course he had. Change of mind. Let go of him, she told the dog, but her voice was now meek and sad and strengthless. The dog barely twitched its ears at the sound of it and didn't pause at all. It merely went on pulling the thing with the disarrayed widow's peak and the blotchy complexion. This thing no longer looked like Disco Gerald, not a bit. Now it was only dead Gerald, sliding across the bedroom floor with a dog's teeth buried in its flabby biceps. A frayed flap of skin hung over the dog's snout. Jessie tried to tell herself it looked like wallpaper, but wallpaper did not, at least as far as she knew, come with moles and a vaccination scar. Now she could see Gerald's pink, fleshy belly, marked only by the small caliber bullet hole that was his navel. His penis flopped and dangled in its nest of black pubic hair. His buttocks whispered along the hardwood boards with ghastly, frictionless ease. Abruptly, the suffocating atmosphere of her terror was pierced by a shaft of anger so bright it was like a stroke of heat lightning inside her head. She did more than accept this new emotion. She welcomed it. Rage might not help her get out of this nightmarish situation, but she sensed it would serve as an antidote to her growing sense of shocked unreality. "You bastard," she said in a low, trembling voice. "You cowardly, slinking bastard."
That's Stephen King reading from his new novel, Gerald's Game. Do you think of yourself as having taken the horror novel to a kind of more physically explicit place than it had ever been before?
Yeah, I think that to some degree I did do that. I think probably I've been surpassed in that area by some of the people who've come after me. I'm thinking mostly of Clive Barker.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you realize that when I started reading and experiencing horror, some of it that I was reading and experiencing came from a very graphic wellspring. And I'm thinking about the horror comics of the 1950s, things like Tales from the Crypt and the mm-hmm. Vault of Horror that can now be seen on home box office. And at the same time, I was discovering horror movies. I usually went by myself in the afternoon to the Highway Theater in Stratford, Connecticut, which is still there, incidentally, and saw things like I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon, or I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, or whatever it happened to be. And it was there that I started to see that it might be possible to combine some of the classic elements with some of the things that I was seeing in the schlock press and the schlock movies.
When you would see movies like this, did they scare you or just amuse you?
No, they scared me. You have to remember that we're talking 10 or 11 years old, and even with a picture like Teenage Monster, where the flying saucer appeared to be a cool cigarette filter tip with a sparkler stuck in it, that it looked real to me because I was at a young and very credulous age. And one of the other things that I sensed as time went past and I got a little more discriminating in my ability to detect special effects, if not necessarily my sense of taste, was that when I wrote it, you never saw the zipper going up the monster's back, that when the imagination was in charge of special effects, they were always perfect as the book was, anyway.
Mm-hmm. What did you like about being scared when you were young?
I liked the total surrender of emotional control. It was very important to me, and I would almost be willing to say sort of a lifesaver. I'd been raised in a family where emotional control was a really important thing. You weren't supposed to show you were afraid. You weren't supposed to show that you were in pain or frightened or sad. Happiness was permissible as long as it didn't go too far, because then one might be considered to be almost insane if one got too happy. So that emotional control was, you know, sort of a requirement. And for me, the terror was what really appealed to something that I think is probably just inside people, that there isn't any logical way to explain it. But I loved it, and I loved giving up that control.
Now, what about when you passed real terror? I mean, for instance, if you would pass a car accident, would you look or turn the other way?
I can't remember that a lot of that ever happened in my life. What I can remember is making a very clear and conscious differentiation between make-believe horror like I Was a Teenage Werewolf and something real that happened. When I was a kid, at around the same time that Michael Landon was playing that werewolf, the make-believe werewolf, there was a kid named Charlie Starkweather who took his girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate, and the two of them went on a killing spree across the Midwest. They killed, I don't know, 10 or 11 people in Nebraska and then over in Wyoming where they were captured. And he was put to death in the electric chair. And I kept a scrapbook about these people. You know, I would cut out the items and paste them in this scrapbook that I had. And my mother was very disturbed about it. This was in the mid-50s, and it was a time when child psychology was not exactly in vogue. But I think that if it had been, she probably would have sent me to one. I think that I can remember her saying, "Why are you interested in these people, Stephen? What is it?" And what I was not able to explain at 10 or 11 years old was, I want to know these people if I ever run into them. Not because they attract me, but because they scare the hell out of me. I want to know what the real beast in the real world looks like so I can steer clear of him or her or them.
My guest is Stephen King. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring a 1992 interview with Stephen King.
To write the kind of fiction that you do, you really have to think about how people respond when they're terrified and how they deal with pain. How they deal with pain and with fear and terror. Do you handle pain well, and has that ability ever really been tested?
You know, I don't think anybody knows how they deal with pain. Everybody's pain is so individual, and so we have no basis for comparison. I think that pain is really the ocean that's between us. You know, when you're dying of cancer, you do it alone, and when you have migraine headaches, which is something that I'm prone to, you do that alone. But if I have a really terrible headache, what I call one of my headbusters, I wonder how that would stack up against someone else's pain. But I don't know, because there's no way to tell. There's no valid basis for comparison because we don't feel each other's pain. The interesting thing to me, more interesting than pain in my life or the comparative levels of that sort of thing, is that experiences about pain and experiences of extreme terror, I think, make it possible to see the world that we live in, the mundane, everyday world, in much greater detail. Small things, unimportant things, stand forth in a way that they don't. My experience of being under tremendous stress, physical stress or emotional or mental stress, is that things that otherwise just sort of fall outside what we think of as the tunnel of perception, our tunnel vision, kind of spring forward again, and I see them all over again. For me and Gerald's game, some of the most interesting passages, there's one section where this woman has to get a glass of water off a shelf, and in another one, she realizes that because she is handcuffed to the bed, she can't quite get the glass to her lips. And what she does then was one of the most interesting and challenging parts of writing the book, not because it's an adventure, but because it uses very prosaic, everyday things to make suspense. And so it makes us look at them again and say, oh, what is that? And that's the experience, it seems to me, of brand new perception, of childhood, that sort of reaction of, oh, look at that. And maybe the adult doesn't see that thing at all.
What have been your greatest moments of terror in which you've experienced this kind of heightened perception?
Gee, I think probably for me, I think probably about 4 years after my wife and I were married, we were living in a little western Maine town called North Windham, and there'd been a snowstorm the night before. And my daughter Naomi was about 3, and my son Joe was about a year and a half old. And they had a snow shovel, and they were shoveling off the porch. And I was putting library books in the car because we were going to go to the library. And I heard my son cry out, and when I turned around, he was lying face down in the snow, and my daughter was standing beside him. They had gotten a hold of the shovel, and each one was trying to pull it away from the other one. And my daughter's grip had slipped, and the shovel had come back and cut him severely with the corner in the face. And when I picked him up out of the snow, he appeared to have no face. It was just blood from the hairline to the chin, with one eye staring out of it. And I was convinced that he was going to die, and if he wasn't going to die, he was probably going to lose one of his eyes. And I remember not knowing what to do, but beyond that, I remember very clearly how the sun made all these little tiny sparkles, millions of sparkles off the snow, and I remember very clearly running with him in my arms into the house to use the telephone, and the way the blood splashed in these droplets like coins on the hardwood floor. These are memories that are very clear in my mind, and their clarity stems directly from the fact that, you know, I was over the moon with terror.
Your son healed well?
He did heal well. Yeah, he has a little tiny scar. It severed the optic nerve, but they were able to sew that back together. So he sees and everything's fine.
Wow. So
not the optic nerve. They couldn't have fixed that. It severed the tear duct.
Huh. After having experienced something like this and experienced the terror of it, how did you feel about going back and writing about this kind of physical terror? Did you feel like now that it had happened to your family, you should kind of back off a little bit?
No, I don't think so. I don't see any correlation between the writing and my daily life in this sense. I don't think that the writing of terrible things serves as some kind of magic hex symbol, like on a barn door. You know, the way that the Amish put the hex signs up, and the idea was to keep the bad luck out of the barn.
Mm-hmm.
They were very religious people. They are very religious people, but that's never stopped them at all from the hex symbols. No more than it stops an atheist, you know, from tossing salt over his shoulder when he spills it. But I never saw the act of writing about terrible things as a way to hedge my bets, a kind of supernatural throwing salt over my shoulder. Nor did I ever think that writing about stories of terror would in some way, you know, cause those things to happen, that it wouldn't do either one. What I can tell you that about this is that I did write a book called Pet Cemetery a few years ago, in which a very small child runs into a road and is run over by a truck and killed. And at that time, when I got ready to write that book, my wife and all three of our kids were living in a little town not too far from where I'm talking to you. And Owen was about the age that Joe was when he got hit by the snow shovel. And at that time, he was just walking or toddling along, and it became great fun to play get away from mother and get away from father. And we were having a picnic, and he got off the blanket and ran straight toward the road, Route 15 up here, which is a very busy road, a lot of trucks going back and forth. And he was running for the road as fast as his little legs could carry him, and I could hear the truck coming. And I ran, and I caught him. And I caught him by one leg, and he went face forward into the gravel on the shoulder of the road. And a few seconds later, the truck went by, a great big one that would have killed us both if we'd gone into the road. And that happens a lot in life. In fact, that's one of the more convincing arguments for the existence of God, is how many times the truck passes us by and how few times it ends up flattening somebody. So when I wrote Pet Cemetery and the truck actually hits the kid, what I was saying to myself is, I want to know what would have happened. I want to explore what life would have been like if my youngest son had been killed instead of, you know, living to be what he is now, which is a big 15-year-old kid who's happy most of the time and getting A's in school and that sort of thing. And I think that it's a really human desire to want to peek through the keyhole into hell.
Stephen King, recorded in 1992. We'll hear more of that interview on the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, more pain and terror. It's the second part of our talk with Stephen King, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Metallica's latest CD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're featuring a 1992 interview with Stephen King. He currently has 5 books on the bestseller list, his novel Rose Matter, and 4 installments of his serial thriller, The Green Mile. ABC will air a miniseries remake of The Shining next winter. I asked Stephen King what he's most afraid of.
Probably, of all the things that I am afraid of, the thing that I would be the most afraid of is losing my reason, losing my sanity, and in particular, I think, losing the ability to differentiate between reality and unreality. I know that it happens, and I've had some personal experience with people who have lost that ability, at least temporarily, to differentiate between what's real and what's not. And for somebody with a strong imagination, somebody particularly who sort of trained that imagination, it's akin to having a cage full of tigers and then coming in one day and somebody saying, "We're sorry, the lock doesn't work anymore. They can all come out whenever they want to."
Right. Well, that reminds me, if this isn't too personal, did you do hallucinogenics or smoke marijuana when you were younger, and did that let the beasts out?
I never really smoked much pot. Yeah, I was a child of the 60s, and I would say I dropped a fair amount of acid. I never exactly took a bath in it. I can't remember. Probably between 8 and 16 trips of varying degrees what would we call it? Heaviness, I guess you'd say. And I don't think that they made much difference one way or another in what I wrote. What I remember is having a sort of feeling after the good trips. I never really had any bad trips. And I certainly don't recommend the LSD experience to anyone. I thought even the best trips were really sort of tiring and wearing. But I do remember having a feeling of almost as though the junk man had driven into my head and loaded up all the old garbage and trucked it away.
I think it must have been in the late 60s that you were given a 4F, a medical deferment, from the draft. And I believe you got the deferment for high blood pressure, limited vision, flat feet, and punctured eardrums. Makes you not exactly sound like the perfect physical specimen. Did you play that up for the draft board or
No,
did
I really
have
didn't.
All those problems?
I really didn't. You know, earlier on we were talking about pain, and it's only one eardrum that's punctured. And this is a very clear memory, even though it goes back to when I was about 3 years old. I had some sort of a terrible ear infection with a lot of infected matter behind the eardrum. And my mother took me to a doctor, and the same medication doesn't... The medication that they have for this sort of thing today didn't exist then. And they held me down, and my mother said, "You have to be very brave now." And I remember the doctor coming with this needle that was about 6 inches long, and he slid it into my ear and punctured the eardrum with the needle and let out a quantity of infected pus and blood and that sort of thing. And the pain was like, if you can imagine a bee the size of a Cocker Spaniel sticking its stinger in your ear, it was like that. It went right through to the other side. It was excruciating. And a week later, my mother said, we have to go back and do it again. And I remember that I wet my pants, and then I went and I crawled in the closet, and she had to pull me out by the legs, and she got me down there to the doctors, and that time it took four people to hold me down, and I was only three, and they did it again. So I do have the punctured eardrums and scars in there and that sort of thing, and I've had a couple of nasty infantile-type ear infections in there since then. But, yeah, it's all true.
God, that sounds absolutely horrible.
It was. But enough about my pain. Let's talk about your pain.
Boy. So I guess, were you not a very physical kid when you were growing up?
No, I would say that I was, I don't know how to answer that. I was and I wasn't. I had a lot of the physical attributes of the absolute bookworm slash nerd slash wallflower, whatever you... In other words, I was overweight, I was kind of podgy, and I wore thick glasses. And at the same time, I became a big kid. I'm a big man. I stand about 6'4" and weigh about 210. And I think that I probably would have been more physical, more of an athlete and that sort of thing if I hadn't grown up in such small towns. But the baseball field was also a potato field, and the nearest high school was 7 miles away. That's where I went. And so extracurricular activities like baseball and football became sort of impossible. I was kind of a poor kid. My mother did not drive or have a driver's license, so we were kind of out of luck.
In high school, you were already writing, and you published something called The Village Vomit. What was it?
The Village Vomit was a satiric newspaper in which I made fun of a lot of teachers. And eventually, I got picked up, as those things always do. That's one of the ways that we learn to either direct our impulses into more healthy channels or... to do what I did, which was to try and do those things outside of school, since I knew that for me, healthy channels was a lost cause early on. But I was called into the principal's office, and the teachers I'd made fun of were there, and the ones who were younger teachers kind of laughed it off, and the ones who were older were just horrified, and there was a kind of, what's this younger generation coming to kind of reaction. And I was almost suspended from school, and in the end... the administration had mercy and suggested that maybe what I needed to do instead of perverting this God-given talent was to put it to work. So they got me a job with a local newspaper called the Lisbon Enterprise that published once weekly. This is a kind of small-town paper that has a lot of articles about 90-year-old ladies in nursing homes doing jigsaw puzzles and knitting afghans. And, you know, Miss Jolene Aubuchon's brother is coming to visit from Nebraska and that sort of thing. And I became the entire sports department. And the first column that I brought in was a column about a local high school kid who'd broken a basketball scoring record. And the editor took a look at it and went through it and struck out every adverb I'd put in there and most of the flowery descriptions and basically taught me my craft. And he did it in about 7 minutes.
What an incredibly smart thing for the principal or whoever to have done for you.
Well, I made money, too. I mean, it was I can't remember whether it was a quarter, a column inch, or what it was, but I wrote everything for the next year, whether it was Little League baseball, whether it was football, whether it was league bowling. That was me. That was Stephen King writing sports, and I filled up two or three pages with this stuff every week. And then... years later, and I'm talking many years later, in 1989, my youngest son's Little League team won the state championship and went down to Bristol, Connecticut to compete in the Little League regional playoffs, I guess they call them. And I wrote it up for the New Yorker. I did a piece, and it sold to the New Yorker, let's put it that way. And the guy who edited the piece said, gee, you for a novelist, you really write sports well. Where did you learn? And I said, well, that's what I was trained as, a sports writer, not a horror novelist.
Stephen King is my guest. We'll take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶
On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring a 1992 interview with Stephen King.
Your first novel was Carrie. That was published when you were 26 years old. What made you head in the direction of horror fiction? I mean, especially after having started off on this newspaper where you were writing about sports.
Yes, I wrote horror all along. It's just something that I've done. I mean, there's a thing inside me that inclines naturally in that direction, like a compass needle toward true north. And I had written a lot of stories that I'd sold to men's magazines, like Cavalier and Dude and Gent, for $200, $300. And at that time, I was working in a laundry, actually washing motel sheets. And this was a step up from my first job as a guy who pumped gas at Interstate 95 and gave away free loaves of bread with a fill-up. So you can see that I was on my way up, you know, in the world of commerce. But the short stories were what was bridging the gap for my wife and I financially between my salary and what we needed to keep two little kids in diapers and amoxicillin for their ear infections and the rest of the stuff. And if you ask me why we ever had two kids, you know, before I even had a job as a teacher, the answer is I don't know. It isn't that they were unplanned. They weren't either planned or unplanned. They just, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Everything that I did up to about the age of 30, it seems like I did with a low-grade fever. I can't really remember the reasons for any of the things. I can only say that it seemed reasonable at the time. So I was writing these short stories, and one of them was supposed to be Carrie. And it was going to be, you know, a 4,000-word wonder. And maybe a $200 check or something like that. And I began to see two things as I got into it. One was that I didn't know anything about girls in high school. And the other thing was that even if I did write it, it was going to be a lot longer than the market that I had in mind. So I threw it away and started to do something else that would, you know, produce a quick turnaround in terms of some money that we needed. And my wife was the one who fished it out of the wastebasket and looked at it and said, I think this is pretty good. And I said, well, I think it's all right, but I don't have time to do it, and I don't know enough. And she said, well, I'll tell you the stuff about the secret lives of girls, if you will, that you don't know. I'll give away all these lodge secrets.
Oh.
And you go back to work on it and finish it, because there's more money here eventually than there is in what you're doing. So I did, and she was right.
Was it your wife who suggested the menstruation scene where Carrie gets her period in gym class and she's teased mercilessly by all the girls?
No, I wanted to do the menstruation scene because I'd read a number of articles about psychokinesis or telekinesis, mind over matter, basically, that suggested that a lot of these phenomena took place in homes where there were young girls who had either just entered puberty or were about to enter puberty. And what that means for me in terms of young women is that first period, the menstruation thing. And so I thought, what a traumatic experience. And if somebody really had a power like that, surely it would come out at that particular moment. That would be like a kind of coming of age. But then I ran into, because I've always been sort of a picky writer about details, I'm not comfortable with writing anything unless I can see into a place, unless I can see what's on my left or what's on my right or the rest of the things. And I couldn't see the girls' locker room because I'd never been in a girls' locker room. So what Tabby did was she got me on a Saturday morning and we went down to John Babst High School, which is where she went to school, and she took me into the girls' locker room. And I got a chance to walk around and see what there was to see. And the only thing that I clearly remember about that period was that my concept that there were coin dispensary machines to, you know, you, in other words, you'd put a quarter and get a sanitary pad or whatever, that was not true. And I said, oh, I thought these would be coin-op. And she just kind of laughed and gave me this funny look and said, the school doesn't charge girls, you know, who forget to bring a pad when it's their time of the month. So at that point, although it sounds ridiculous, I became comfortable with the idea because I could see into the shower room, I could see into the girls' locker room. And once I was able to see that, I was able to see everything else. And when Brian De Palma's movie came out and he went into the locker room to begin with, I just kind of laughed because it didn't look anything like the one at John Babst High School.
Right, right, right. When you started publishing your novels and people started reading them and people who you knew understood more What went through your mind, the kind of thoughts that you had? Did people start to see you differently?
I think so. There was a sort of, I won't say pulling away exactly, but a kind of, you'd see a kind of question in their eyes, sort of like, where are all the bodies buried, Steve? or there would be this sort of casual, by the way, Steve, what was your childhood like? Were you ever beaten? Did they burn you with cigarettes or what was it? And I would say, really, I'm just like you are. And then they would step away.
That would be the worst news.
Yeah. Basically, all I'm doing is saying things that other people are afraid to say. The job's not much different than being a comedy writer. Basically, you say, what is the one thing that nobody wants to talk about that everybody will sort of raise their hands in horror? Well, not everybody, because you never get everybody, but what can I say that will be the literary equivalent of taking a fork and scraping it across a blackboard, you know, or making somebody bite in on a lemon? And when I find those things, generally the reaction from the readers or the people even who see the films is one of, thank you for saying that. Thank you for articulating that thought.
Your story, Misery, was about a psychotic fan who tortures her favorite writer because he's let her down with the plot of the new novel.
Mm-hmm.
and you, in a way, have become a kind of magnet for a few kind of crazy fans. Was the story of Misery based on one particular fear or one particular incident?
I don't think so. There are a number of things. Yes, I've been a lightning rod for a certain number of crazy people. We keep files on them. They are constant correspondents, and they want to be infinitely, intimately involved with my life or the lives of my family or whatever. Or they believe that they actually wrote the stories or that you're picking their brains telepathically or whatever it is. But I think more than anything else, I was thinking about John Lennon and how it was a fan that killed him. And I guess there have been several cases of stalking, the David Letterman thing, where this woman keeps turning up in his house.
Mm-hmm.
So those things went through my mind, along with my own fan mail and my own realization that life had become suspiciously like living in front of a large picture window all the time. And you begin to realize the power of fans. And, of course, it's just interacting with them, there is a kind of fan psychology that for the object of that fan adulation gets to be really, really uncomfortable sometimes. They want your autograph. They want to tell you how much they enjoy their stuff. And if you say, look, I'd love to sign your books, but I can't right now. I'm taking my family out to dinner, or I really have to be over here. Their reaction is, go to hell, you son of a bitch. You know, just like that, it changes.
Yeah, that's pretty frightening.
So you sense in the people who are the most devoted fans this really sort of churning need to identify emotionally or psychologically with the object of the fan worship. And sometimes this actual resentment, this feeling of you have what was really meant for me. In the best of all possible worlds, I would be you. And you see this quite often in the mail. So there's a lot of times this adulation and there's this really uncomfortable undercurrent of resentment at the same time.
I guess that's an example of the type of horror that you write about coming a little closer to home than you'd like.
Well, I mean, everything that I write about has some sort of referent in actual real life, and not just for famous people, but for anybody. If it doesn't work on some sort of visceral level where you can make the connection with your own life, it really doesn't work at all.
In The Shining, you know, the all work and no play scene? They're at this kind of like haunted hotel, and you know, the guy's trying to write, and we think he's actually writing something, and his wife actually, he tells her, don't look at my manuscript. She goes and looks at it, and it's just pages and pages and pages of all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. And I see this part of the story as like a horror story about just the misery of living with somebody who has writer's block. But that's something you've probably never had. You're so prolific.
Oh, yes, I've had writer's block. I've had writer's block. It just doesn't show, and I think it very rarely does. It's one of those things that people don't talk about, like their bowel problems. And that's what basically what writer's block is. It's a kind of mental constipation. So I have it, and I don't have it right now, and I'm very grateful when I don't. I'm always grateful when it passes, and when I do have a block, when I find that I can't work or I don't have an idea or I can't execute the ideas that I have, I just try to grin and bear it and tell myself it will pass, because it always has.
It seems like you're almost compulsive about the amount that you write.
Isn't almost. I am compulsive.
Right. Do you have to write every day?
No. But if I don't write for a week or a week and a half, there is a voice inside that starts to agitate for a return to the work. And it says all sorts of different things, but at the bottom, it's always the same. The real basic driving force behind that voice seems to be that if you don't use it, you'll lose it. That if I don't write, I'm going to find it impossible to go back and do it, that I will forget how. And I have no idea if there's any truth to that or not, because I've never taken a real long layoff. We talked about writer's block. I've had periods when I've written nothing but crap for as long as a year, but that's not the same thing as not writing at all or not being able to write. It's just, from my mind, it's just sort of working through a bad patch.
Stephen King, it's just been wonderful to talk with you. I thank you very, very much for talking with us.
It's been a great time. Thank you very much.
Stephen King, recorded in 1992. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. Coming up, a review of Metallica's new CD. This is Fresh Air. The most popular hard rock band in the country is Metallica. The band has just released its sixth studio album called Load. Metallica's appeal transcends the pop music genre. This young heavy metal act will also be headlining this summer's Lollapalooza tour, which traditionally features grunge and alternative rock acts. Ken Tucker has this review of Load.
I run, but it stays right by my side. Tear me open, pour me out. The things inside that scream and shout. And the pain still hates me. So hold me until you sleep.
You certainly can't accuse Metallica of being a bunch of cynical goof-offs who exploit their fans. Having sold more than 12 million copies of its previous studio album, Metallica took 5 years to record and release Load, and it sounds it. This is as carefully, meticulously made a hard rock album as I've heard in years. You have to go back to the prime of Led Zeppelin to locate loud music as precisely crafted.
It gotta waste my hate on you. I think I'll keep it.
A lot has happened in Metallica's corner of the music world since their last album came out, and it shows up in ways both superficial and significant on Load. There was a time when Metallica's grinding music, half metal, half punk, was out there on the cutting edge. But while this California band was laboring away at Load, the Seattle grunge bands turned this brutal stuff into mainstream music. In pop music, your audience's perception of you inevitably affects the music you make, because a band as hugely popular as Metallica can't conceive its music in isolation. It's in some part a reaction to various things, to its fans' expectations, to what's happening in the marketplace, to what competing bands have done. One of Metallica's more interesting reactions to all this has been to reveal a softer side, as they do by introducing a kind of guitar they've never used before, a pedal steel, in a song called Mama Said.
Mama, she has taught me well, told me when I was young. Son, your life's an open book, don't close it till it's done. The brightest flame burns quickest, that's what I heard her say. Son's heart sold to mother, but I must find my way. Let my heart go. Let your son go. Mama, let my heart go. Or let this heart be still.
One thing that used to keep me from getting caught up in Metallica's music was its resolute humorlessness. I've been through adolescence, and I didn't have much use for the blowing-off-steam anger and self-pitying moroseness in the songs by lead singer James Hetfield and drummer Lars Ulrich. But Load reveals a Metallica that, while certainly not lightened up, is facing the big bad world like grown-ups. Maturity. It's an attitude that'll probably sell.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Al Banks, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.